Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
Sometimes things get in the way. Big obstacles, little setbacks, but you keep going through the grind, the long nights, with flexible pathways, online, hybrid, and in-person. Indiana Wesleyan University gives you accessible tuition with world-class connections. Where there's a will, there's a way. And with Indiana Wesleyan, there's a way forward. Start today at discovertheway.com.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios. You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering the history of Christian missions to the Mongols. I have to give credit for this episode in a roundabout way to a lovely review that came in a couple of months ago. This review, I cannot read the name on it. It's mostly emojis, but it says, "Hi, I love this podcast so much. It's so cool. More on Roman people." Lots of exclamation points. So thank you for that. It's super cute. So as I went looking for some more Roman people, in the course of that search, I stumbled across something about the Mongols. I don't even remember what it was now, but I thought, ooh, this would make a really interesting episode. And so here we are today. I'm still on the hunt for more Roman people, but in the meantime, let's talk about the Mongols. The Mongol Empire was the second largest empire in the world, the largest, of course, being the British Empire. At its peak, the Mongol Empire spread from the Sea of Japan. Although it was never able to conquer Japan, it did try. All the way to much of Eastern Europe, throughout Central Asia, down into the Middle East. And according to Google, it was the largest contiguous land empire in history. Where did they come from? And the hint is in the name. They came out of the Eurasian steppes in Mongolia. And historically, the steppes, which are actually a few different areas, but they have spawned a few different nomadic people groups that have wreaked havoc in Europe and in Asia going back to ancient times, notably the Huns and the Scythians. The latter Herodotus wrote about, and even the Apostle Paul mentioned them in Colossians 3:11. Here there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. The Scythians were so awful that Paul felt the need to emphasize that even those horrific savages were not too far from God's grace. And the Mongolians also developed a fearsome reputation for themselves, but before they were a united group, annexing large swaths of the world, they were a divided group of nomadic tribes. They were united under Chinggis Khan, who started out as a little guy named Temujin, who was born around 1162, and he was the son of a Mongol chieftain who was assassinated when Temujin was about 9 years old. And this meant that his family grew up poor and isolated, with only their mother to care for him and his siblings. And the family love apparently really wasn't very strong, because he decided to murder his older half-brother to take over as head of the family. He was then captured by his own clan and served as a slave until he managed to escape. He got married, and then when his wife was kidnapped by another clan, he went after her and successfully got her back. He then began gaining followers and making alliances, and by 1206, he had united roughly 1 million Mongols, and they declared him Chinggis Khan, or Universal Ruler. And Chinggis did things differently from the way they had been done in the past. For example, he promoted based on merit and not according to family. And he was known for promoting his former enemies if they impressed him enough during battle. The leaders of all of his enemy clans he would kill, and then he would incorporate the rest. And the traditional religion of the Mongols is animism, specifically Tengri, which is they revered this god of the sky, but there was a lot of ancestor worship However, he was tolerant of other religions and encouraged the flourishing of different religions. His court consisted of Buddhists, Nestorian Christians, Muslims, among others. He abolished inherited aristocratic titles, the selling and kidnapping of women, specifically Mongol women, banned the enslavement of any Mongol, and made livestock theft punishable by death. He also ordered the adoption of a writing system, conducted a regular census, and granted diplomatic immunity to foreign ambassadors. He also started the first Pony Express system for delivering mail throughout the empire, which was later used by Marco Polo, among others. He did deal harshly with those who didn't roll over and allow them to invade or conquer their lands, but he dealt even more harshly with those who killed his emissaries or went back on an alliance or a trade deal. He wiped out an entire empire for that exact same thing and then went back and killed the people who refused his request for aid. Specifically, these people had killed his ambassadors, and so he just went over and wiped them all out. He eventually died in 1227 while attacking a kingdom in northwestern China. And how he died is a mystery. It could have been the plague, he could have fallen from his horse, he could have been stabbed by a princess, or he could have died from an infected arrow wound. To be honest, probably the most boring of those options. And even his burial location is a secret. Supposedly, his funeral retinue killed everybody they came into contact with, sacrificed a couple dozen maidens, and then rode horses over the grave to conceal it. And to be fair, some of those must have been somewhat true because nobody has a clue where his grave is today. And then even the portraits we have of him actually aren't even his likeness. He didn't allow anyone to try and capture his image. And I was reading an article that was like, well, it was because he was just such a humble man. And that's, I mean, like he conquered quite a bit. Like there's nothing about him that would suggest that he is humble. So more than likely, it's because of his animistic beliefs, which believed that if you captured an image of a person, like their soul was partially captured by that. So that's why he most likely did not allow those portraits to be drawn. And then after his death, the empire split into four different groups, each ruled by one of his sons. And I won't bore you with the logistics of each of those empires, but you should know that the Yuan Empire was in China and it was ruling from Beijing. This would be where Kublai Khan ruled from later on. And this part of the empire was considered to be the greatest. And then you have the Golden Horde, which ruled parts of Eastern Europe and was headed up notably by Batu Khan, who converted them to Islam, Uzbek Khan or Uzbek Khan, for whom Uzbekistan is named, and then Yani Khan, who would inflict the first known case of biological warfare against Kaffa. But more on that later. And then you have the Chagatai Khanate in Central Asia. And it doesn't really do anything interesting, so no need to talk about them specifically. And then lastly, you have the Ilkhanate, which hangs out more in the Middle Eastern Persian region and has the most contact with the Crusaders. And I mentioned before that there were Nestorian Christians in the court of Genghis Khan. In fact, it is the only Christianity they seem to have access to at first. And without going into too much detail, the Nestorianism has been considered a heresy by the church since the Council at Ephesus in 431. Nestorius, who was a patriarch of Constantinople and his followers, believed that the humanity of Jesus must be emphasized above his divine. His natures were completely divided. His human nature came from Mary and his divine nature came from God. So he had two natures and two substances. This is contrary to the hypostatic union as we understand it today, which states that Christ is fully human and fully divine, two natures and one substance. And the council decided against him and he was kicked out and went over to Persia, which is modern day Iran, where he was embraced by the Church of the East, at least somewhat. And from that point on, the Church of the West referred to them as the Nestorian Church, even though that's a little bit reductive because not all or even most of the Eastern Church would consider themselves to be Nestorians. But anyway, through trade and missionary endeavors, the Nestorian Christians made their way to the Mongols, and reportedly Genghis Khan's own mother was a Nestorian Christian. The problem with this was not necessarily their misunderstanding of the hypostatic union, but rather that they were syncretists. They still often held to several of the animistic beliefs and paired them with Christianity, creating this confusing theological hodgepodge. And this naturally and inevitably, as you can imagine, leads us to Prester John. Where else would you go? And if you're wondering who is Prester John, nobody knows. But it was a persistent legend for about 500 years, from the 12th century all the way until the 17th century. And Prester John was thought to be a Nestorian patriarch who ruled a Christian nation among Muslims and pagans. And at times, he was said to be a descendant of the Magi, and his land was like a mythical wonderland. And at first, he was said to be in India, because traditionally, the apostle, Thomas the Apostle, was said to have traveled there. And the Nestorians also made it there. And then, when the Mongols were discovered to have Nestorians among them, the legend switched to Central Asia, and then later it switched to Ethiopia, and not because of the Nestorians, but actually because they were their own Christian community that was removed from everybody else. And if you're looking at this aspect of history between the Mongols and the Christians, you will find Prester John all over the place. It's a confusing mess. But this whole thing stemmed from one letter the Byzantine emperor received in 1165, which was signed by John, Christian sovereign and Lord of Lords. This letter claimed that John ruled over rich, opulent, and majestic lands from Persia all the way up into China. And if you're tracking with the dates, you'll know this is prime crusading time, and therefore the thought of some charismatic Christian king coming to the rescue sounded really great. But unfortunately, the Mongols weren't it, because in 1223, the Mongols started their conquests into Europe, ravaging the Kievan Rus and then moving down into Hungary by the 1240s. And there are all sorts of stories about their campaigns against Europe, but the one that I find the most telling is that of their very first battle, a battle not even intended to conquer, but just to plunder. This is the Battle of Kalka River, and the Kievan Rus, who you may know as the descendants of the Vikings, mounted a defense against the army of the Mongols, and they were soundly defeated. It was embarrassingly bad for them. The Mongols had this tradition of giving nobles a bloodless death. And that sounds really nice, right? It's not nice, because after the battle, the Rus princes were rounded up, buried, a wooden victory platform was set up over them where the Mongol officers sat and ate until they were suffocated to death. So I would rather be skewered like a peasant any old day. That sounds awful. And they only turned back around because the great Khan Ogadai, successor to Genghis, had died, and the policy after Genghis Khan died was that all the Mongol leaders had to return to China to elect a new leader. So then Ogadai was ultimately succeeded by his son, Gayuk. Many Western Christians still hoped in Prester John and thought that perhaps these Mongols were his armies. The invasion of Europe tarnished that a bit, but not as much as you would think, because the Pope and others thought they could still be won to Christianity and join their side, and this is the beginning of what is known as the Mongol missions. So in spring of 1245, 63-year-old Giovanni d'Appian de Carpini, maybe? I'm not sure. I'm not Italian. But so for ease, we'll just call him Giovanni. He headed up this journey, readied with two letters. The first condemned the attack on Christian lands, and the second laid out the tenets of the Christian faith and asked them to convert to Christianity. And the journey for Giovanni was primarily diplomatic. He gives the letters to Gayuk, who presumed this was an envoy of submission, and he writes his response, and I'll read it here. It says, "God has ordered us to destroy them and gave them up into our hands. For otherwise, if God had not done this, what could man do to man? But you men of the West believe that you alone are Christians and despise others. But how can you know to whom God deigns to confer his grace? But we, worshiping God, have destroyed the whole earth from east to the west in the power of God. And if this were not the power of God, what could men have done? But if you should not believe our letters and the command of God, nor hearken to our counsel, then we shall know for certain that you wished to have war. After that, we do not know what will happen. God alone knows." Gayuk's response makes sense considering his religious background and experiences. Clearly, God was on the side of the Mongols because he kept giving them victory. And the Pope at this point was not negotiating from a position of strength because the Mongols had just dominated portions of Europe, barely breaking a sweat. Interestingly, Gayuk had this letter translated into Mongolian, Persian, and Uyghur, which is the noble language of the Mongols. The Persian letter was then translated into Latin using proper terminology, demonstrating an understanding of Christianity, which likely surprised the Pope. And one of the reasons that Christians would have trouble converting the Mongols, especially the Mongolian nobility, was due to their understanding of the function of religion. Because Tengri, their animistic belief system, was concerned with the here and now. It didn't concern itself with the afterlife or the consequences of behavior because you stayed on as whatever you had been in life. So if you were a con in life, you were a con in death. And rewards came in this life and not in the next, and therefore the Mongols felt no need to convert to any particular religion. Now, it is interesting, though, how tolerant they were of other religions. They had representatives from differing faiths in their courts and would regularly host debates between them to discern which ones were the most accurate. So this simultaneous closed-minded but yet open-mindedness must have been baffling to those first European representatives. But it also explains the syncretism, because they seemed to hold an overarching viewpoint, but then they pulled in other elements from various religions as it suited them. And this can be seen through the burial customs employed at the death of a Nestorian Christian chieftain following his defeat at the hands of Genghis Khan. His head was taken by other Nestorian Christians, placed in white felt and venerated, and they also made offerings of liquor to it. During this time period, the Mongols expressed almost a manifest destiny attitude. They were untouchable and the world was theirs for the taking. It wasn't until their fracturing and division in 1294, which saw more infighting and military defeats, that they became more open to other religions. However, with all that being said, there is an account of martyrdom which occurred while Giovanni was with Batu Khan of the Golden Horde, presumably while he was returning from visiting the Great Khan. And it shows that this idea of religious tolerance only went so far where the reverence for Genghis Khan was concerned. Giovanni was an eyewitness to this event, and he recounts, "When Michael, one of the princes of Russia, came to submit to Batu, the Mongols first tried to make him pass between two fires. After this, they said that he should bow south to Genghis Khan, but he replied that he would gladly bow to Batu and his servants, but not to the image of a dead man, because this is improper for a Christian. When he was repeatedly told through his son Yaroslav that he must bow, he refused. Batu ordered Prince Michael killed if he would not bow. Prince Michael of Chernigov was passed between the fires in accordance with the ancient Turco-Mongol tradition. Batu Khan sent to stab him to death for his refusal to do obeisance to Genghis Khan's shrine in the pagan ritual imposed by the conqueror. The prince replied that he preferred to die rather than do what was wrong. Batu sent Michael to one of his followers, who trampled on his chest with his boots until the prince died. Meanwhile, the prince comforted one of his soldiers who stood nearby him by saying, 'Be strong, because your punishment will not last long, and then at once eternal joy will follow.' After this, his head was cut off quickly with a knife. The soldier, to tell the truth, also had his head cut off with a knife." Concurrent with Giovanni's trip was that of Aslan of Lombardy, who was sent out by the Pope to visit a different Khan, and he was a Dominican friar who was absolutely a terrible envoy, which makes sense because he belonged to the order of heretic hunters responsible for the Inquisitions later on, of course. He didn't bring any gifts at all and then refused to treat the Mongols with civility unless they accepted baptism, which really made them upset. The Mongols replied that they couldn't care about becoming Christians and dogs as they were, that the Pope was a dog and that they were dogs themselves. So Azalin and his little entourage were condemned to death by the Khan and only left with their lives because of the honor that Mongols assigned to envoys. And he brought back a letter to the Pope which demanded that he come personally and submit. And then two Mongol envoys brought back the Pope's response, which read, "Better that you humble yourself before Christ face to face and recognize his great forbearance, who for so long has endured your destructive actions, that in waiting obligingly you may be turned from errors to truth, and be able to fear him, lest he provoked for too long a time should threaten you with the lash of his anger, since you do not recognize his omnipotence." Another friar, this time a Franciscan named Lawrence of Portugal, left around the same time for the purpose of ministering among the Mongols in a religious capacity, and he traveled to the Ilkhanate as well, but nothing is known of his fate. It's presumed he never left, but whether that was by choice, we don't know. The next mission in our lineup here was André de Langemoux, who was a French diplomat and a Dominican order missionary. He had also previously been dispatched to the East by King Louis IX, who is Saint Louis, to fetch the crown of thorns, which was bought from the Emperor of Constantinople. And it's actually been venerated as the original crown of thorns since about 400 AD. And it was housed in Notre Dame until the fire happened, and then it was moved to the Louvre for safekeeping. And now it is back in Notre Dame. Is it the actual crown of thorns? Probably not, but it is interesting how long it's been around. André had already been on a papal mission to the Mongols once before, and now he was headed out again for King Louis, because two Eastern Christians operating as envoys for the Mongols, came to King Louis with an offer of alliance against the Syrians. So Andre heads out, laden with gifts appropriate for a Khan, and it took them a year to arrive, and when they did, they found out that Gayuk had just died, supposedly poisoned by Batu, who was heading up the Golden Horde. Apparently, those two had been in a power struggle for a long time, and Gayuk's widow accepted the gifts, but then sent back a letter which blatantly and rudely turned down the offer of an alliance. But the joke is on her, though, because she wasn't able to hold onto the throne for her family, and it went to Monge Khan, who was a grandson of Genghis. Now, on the way back, Andre sees German Christians who had been taken prisoner being made to walk between the fires and to pay homage to Genghis Khan while simultaneously submitting to the Mongols, which shows that this cult-like deification of him was growing. This attempt at an alliance fizzled out, but it was neither the first nor the last attempt at an alliance between the East and the West. But before we go into any of that, let's talk about the most well-known of the Mongol missions, which was headed up by a Franciscan from Flanders, William of Rubric. William of Rubric had joined King Louis IX on the Seventh Crusade, another failed crusade, where King Louis actually gets himself kidnapped and then is held for ransom. But then after he is released, he stays in the Holy Land for a few more years. And it seems like William must have stayed with him because he was sent out to evangelize to the Mongols in 1253 and to meet with the son of Batu Kong, whose name was Sartek, who had supposedly been converted to Christianity. So William was sent out the year before Louis returned to Europe, symbolizing that they probably were in the same area there. But William must have been quite a voracious reader, which checks out because he is a monk. But he read up heavily on all the previous missions to the Mongols, as well as the routes that they took. And through Eastern Europe, he took the route of Friar Julian, who was the first European to find the Magyars, who were the ancestors of the Hungarians. He found them living in the European part of Russia. This was roughly 1235, and amazingly, when he found them, they had been removed from the Hungarians for about 300 to 400 years, but they could still understand each other, and they were the first to tell him of the Mongols, and when he returned to them about 2 years later, they had been all but destroyed by the Mongols. So Friar Julian was the first European to bring back factual news and not whimsical fairy tales from Asia, as well as news of an impending Mongol invasion. And despite the heads up, Europe still wasn't ready 5 years later, and they totally decimated Hungary. Interestingly, they used the tactics of their ancestors, the Magyars, with horseback archery and all that, but the Hungarians were soft city boys by this point and got taken to the woodshed. Bad day for them. But anyway, Friar Julian's travels were vitally important to future explorers and missionaries like William of Rubric. We have a detailed history of literally everything William encountered and experienced while he was with the Mongols. He gave a lengthy 40-chapter-long report to King Louis on his return, and I'll read you the whole thing in its entirety. Just kidding. I'll run us through the highlights here. He says that when they arrived in Mongol lands, they were surrounded by an army of horsemen, reminiscent of the scene where the Rohirrim ride up on the Fellowship. And he didn't say that, obviously, because Peter Jackson hadn't been born yet, but that's what it reminds me of. And they demanded to know what he wanted, what they were carrying, demanded food and wine, and William says they were just generally unpleasant and entitled. He said he had orders to meet their captain, the supposed convert, and so they waved him on, and it felt like leaving this group of devils. They were just awful. And for 2 months, they carried on towards Sartek. He says they never slept in a tent, but either out in the open air or under their carts. And they also never saw any cities, but they did see vast amounts of Kuman graves, which were the people the Mongols had been pursuing when they added Hungary to their list of places to conquer. One evening, their guide gave them this kumis to drink, which is fermented mare's milk with the butter removed. And he said that he broke out in a sweat with horror and surprise at the taste of it, which doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement to me, but he said it was quite palatable, so maybe it's like an acquired taste or something. And on their way to Sartek, they came across another noble and were given a translator, and this translator expected expensive gifts, and he was angry when they couldn't provide them, but they gave a basket of gifts to the noble, asking to be excused because their Christian order didn't allow them to carry gold or silver or expensive robes. And he accepted their gifts and a letter, including one from the Emperor of Constantinople. And he asked if they were able to join him in drinking kumis because the Christians among them, or seemingly really of all the sects around them, refused to drink it and thought it would cost them their salvation. So in light of this, they opted just for regular drinks, and the noble asked them what they would say to Sartek, and they said that they would tell him the words of the Christian faith, and then he asked what those words would be, and they explained the tenets to him of the faith, and through the translator, although he was really bad at his job, he wasn't a great translator, and to make matters worse, he was drunk most of the time. But while they were there, among them, the day of Pentecost came, and they were joined by some Christians who were of a nomadic tribe originally from Persia who had migrated north at some point. And they offered them meat and asked them to pray for their dead. But then William told them that they had to abstain from meat on the eve of Pentecost and then explained the holiday to them because they were unfamiliar with it, which also gives insight into how little these people knew of their own faith. And they also asked if they could drink kumis. Apparently, the reason why they were so against the drink was because it was considered food offered to idols by the Ruthenian Christians who were numerous in the area. And the Ruthenians are really interesting because they seem to be a Slavic people who were somehow mixed in Catholic traditions and Greek traditions, but seemingly in the most Pharisaical way. And the issue was such a stumbling block to the faith that the next day, a Muslim man approached William and they expounded the faith with him all day, and he wanted to accept baptism. When he suddenly just took off, leapt on his horse, and said he had to talk with his wife. And the next day, he said he could not possibly accept baptism because he wouldn't be able to drink kumis, which was essential to live in the deserts. No matter what they said, he would not be swayed from that opinion. After this setback, they continued on towards Sartek and finally reached him what seemed like ages later, and their translator is once again scandalized because they do not have any gifts to bring. And when they are presented to Sartek, he is playing a guitar and the people are dancing before him. And this has to be somewhat customary because it's been mentioned before in his account. But William apologized for the lack of gifts, emphasizing their poor status as monks. And Sartek understood and was not offended in the slightest. He then asked who William thought was the most powerful lord in Europe. And William thought about it for a minute and answered that he thought that Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, if not for all the troubles in his lands and personal life, was the most powerful. And Frederick at this point is in a political and literal war with the Pope. He was excommunicated more than once. And during one of those times, he led a crusade and then crowned himself king of Jerusalem before the Muslims took it back. And he had to leave in disgrace. And I'm pretty sure I read somewhere they actually threw trash at him as he left. The people did. It was wild. But Pope Innocent IV also plotted a coup against him to have him killed. Frederick found out about it and then mutilated everyone responsible. And honestly, his life would make a really epic movie. He's a terrible person, but that's probably what would make it really interesting. Surprisingly, however, Sartek answered that William was wrong, that the greatest lord in Europe was Louis IX. We'll talk more about that in a minute. And Sartek also said that there were some matters in King Louis' letter which would need to be brought back to his father, Batu Khan, and so they journeyed on to him. And Batu Khan's entourage was like a vast city and was so well organized that William likened it to what the encampments of the Israelites must have looked like in the presence of the tabernacle. And when William and his companions were presented to Batu, and William shared the gospel with them, including the possibility of eternal damnation, this horrified his interpreter, by the way, but Batu and his entourage just laughed or were otherwise unbothered. In fact, Batu wanted them to stay, but in order to do that, they had to go on to Mange Khan, who was the great Khan in China. And so William, his companion, and their translator traveled on with Batu's army. Now, side note here is that literally nobody was feeding these people. They were surviving off of old biscuits and kumis and rotten milk, and they had been since they arrived in Mongol lands. No idea what was going on there, but they must have looked and felt absolutely terrible.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
Sometimes things get in the way. Big obstacles, little setbacks, but you keep going through the grind, the long nights. With flexible pathways, online, hybrid, and in-person, Indiana Wesleyan University gives you accessible tuition with world-class connections. Where there's a will, there's a way. And with Indiana Wesleyan, there's a way forward. Start today at discovertheway.com.
And as they're traveling, William gives a detailed accounting of the people in the Khan's land. And the medieval period is just so strange. He wrote this about the Tibetans. Beyond these are the Tibet, a people in the habit of eating their dead parents so that they should not give their parents any other sepulcher than their bowels. They have given up this practice, however, as they were held an abomination among all nations. They still, however, make handsome cups out of the heads of their parents so that when drinking out of them, they may have them in mind in the midst of their merrymaking. This was told to me by one who had seen it. As they carried on, he came across some Germans who had been enslaved by the Mongols and had no priest among them to administer the sacraments or guide them in the faith, and he wished to stay on with them for a little while to help encourage them and see to their spiritual needs, but he wasn't allowed to leave the caravan, and these people weighed on his mind the entire time that he was in the Khan's entourage, and later on he would ask to be able to be sent back to them, and he was told no. But when they arrived in the court of Mongke Khan, William tried to go barefoot, as was the custom of the Franciscans, and the people gathered around him like he was a monster, and they asked whether he just had no use for his feet because it was so cold. They thought that he would surely lose them, and a Hungarian who happened to be in the group and recognized his order just told them that this is kind of what they do. But the next morning, William had to give it up because he was already in danger of losing a couple of his toes. While they were waiting to be admitted to the Khan, William met an Armenian monk who had arrived the month before. He had been in Jerusalem when he said that God had appeared to him three times and told him to go to the great Khan. He had refused the first two times, and on the third time he said that God struck him to the ground and told him that he would die if he refused. And he was to tell the Khan that if he became a Christian and served him, then all the world would be his, and the Franks and the popes would serve him. And so he tells William to speak just as brashly because they were envoys of God, and that was greater than any envoy to man. And William agrees with this, but he said he would speak the truth of Christendom to him as he would to all men, but he would not speak so as to allow or encourage the slavery of Western Christendom to the Khan. My personal theory on this monk is that he was not in his right mind. He would pretend to fast. He would deny them food and then have this secret stash of food that he would then eat from when nobody else was there. He would also give patients a rhubarb drink so bitter that it gave them diarrhea, but they thought it was something holy because they could feel it working inside. It was just the impending doom. But then he actually killed a priest with one of his concoctions because he had been opposed to them. This priest had been opposed to them and wished to talk to the Khan about William and his entourage. And even though he had repented to William and they were on good terms, he still killed this guy. So just a little strange. Anyway, William gets to meet with the Khan, and Mongke grants him leave to stay for 2 months until the worst of the winter was over. He also asks him a lot of questions about the Franks and their fortifications, seemingly with the intention to see how easy they would be to invade. And William is very, very frustrated with this, and he has to hold in his indignation. And as an aside, it is amazing the Mongols ever got anything accomplished, because literally everything they did involved drinking copious amounts of alcohol. Even the monks and the priests would get raucous on the regular and then would beg William for the wine given to him by the Khan so they could carouse and sing and shout. And it really just sounds like being trapped in a 24/7 frat party, but the fraternity president could have you killed at any point. William seemed to come into the Khan's presence, or at least his court, quite frequently, but most of his stories are surrounding the other members of the court or various people being ill or feast days. He did say that the monk, the Armenian monk, swore that he had baptized the Khan, although William refused to believe him because he had asked this monk to tell him when that was happening so he could be present. And then the Nestorians said that it had happened, but William just didn't believe them either. And what was happening in reality was that the Khan had all these religions wrapped around his finger. Each group, the Christians, the Muslims, the Buddhists, and the pagans, all thought that he was one of theirs, but in reality, he just kept them dancing to a tune like some kind of Pied Piper. And I think the infighting and the rivalry really amused him. The only one I think he even gave any credence to were the pagans, because he refused to do anything until he had consulted the bones. His first wife, who had since died, may have been a Christian, but he definitely was not. William includes another one of his what-in-the-world stories that occurred while he was in court. He wrote that one day a priest from Cathay, which is northern China, was seated with me, and he was dressed in red stuff of the finest hue, and I asked him whence had come such a color, and he told me that in the countries east of Cathay there are high rocks among which dwell creatures who have in all respects human forms, except that their knees do not bend, so they get along by some kind of jumping motion, and they are not over a cubit in length, and all over their little body is covered in hair, and they live in inaccessible caverns, and the hunters go carrying with them mead, with which they can bring on great drunkenness, and they make cup-like holes in the rocks and fill them with this mead, so the hunters hide themselves, and these animals come out of their caverns and taste this liquor. And they cry, chin, chin. So they have been given a name from this cry. They are called chin, chin. And then they come out in great numbers and drink this mead, and they get drunk and they fall asleep. And then the hunters come, who then they bind the sleeper's feet and hands. And after that, they open a vein in their necks and take out 3 or 4 drops of blood and let them go free. And this blood, he told me, was most precious for coloring purples. He also told me as a fact, which I do not believe, however, that there is a province beyond Cathay, and at whatever age a man enters it, that age he keeps, which he had on entering. So on one hand, the medieval period would have been awful to live through, but then you hear stuff like this, and you're like, what a time to be alive, right? It's really weird, very strange. But it had been about 5 or 6 months since William had arrived at the Khan's, and he wanted to know whether he would be allowed to stay. And so the Khan sent messengers back that he wished him to go back to his own country, but he asked if he would take some Mongol ambassadors with him, which William replied that he would not dare risk his ambassadors through these dangerous lands, although it's really not clear why he said no. It's possible that he just thought there was no need. But anyway, he is eventually asked into the presence of the Khan, and he recounts that experience. He says that the Khan began confiding to me his creed. We Mongol, he said, believe that there is only one God by whom we live and by whom we die, and for whom we have an upright heart. And then I said, may it be so, for without his grace this cannot be. The Khan then added, but as God gives us different fingers of the hand, so he gives to men several paths. God gives you the scriptures, and you Christians keep them not. He told William that he was an exception to this. The Khan said that he gave us divination, and we do what they tell us, and we live in peace. And William says he was listening attentively for him to say something else of his creed when he began talking of William's return journey, saying, you have stayed here a long while. I wish you to go back. You said that you would not dare take my ambassadors with you, but will you take my words or my letter? And from that moment forward, he never found an opportunity nor the time when he could share with him the faith. And William closes out by saying that if I had had the power to work by signs and wonders like Moses, perhaps he would have humbled himself. Interestingly, the envoy that made King Louis send William to the Khan in the first place proved to be a false envoy. This was proven by the Khan's disdain for him. Sartek was never thought to be a Christian, and this envoy knew it. In fact, Marco Polo later writes that it was known that he, like Mongke Khan, liked wrapping each religion around his finger and giving favoritism to whomever sent him the most gifts. I mentioned earlier that Batu felt that the true power in Europe was Louis IX. And that reputation only continued to spread because Hulagu Khan, who was the founder of the Ilkhanate near the Crusader States, wrote to King Louis in 1262, proposing an alliance between the two of them. He wanted Louis to send ships and land his troops so they could attack the Mamluks in Egypt, and these Mamluks were the former slaves of the Ayyubid dynasty. The Mamluks had taken over and overthrown their rulers in 1250, and they had defeated the Mongols in 1260, causing them to retreat from the Levant or the Holy Land Crusader State area. And Hulagu promised Louis that he would give him Jerusalem as an incentive to help them. And this letter strayed from the usual overtures of the Mongols, which commanded the reader to submit or to die. It was still imperial in nature, but it was much more cordial and even included 2 Bible verses. Now, these were out of context to bolster their claims of superiority, but they were there. Ahulagu was actually a mixture of Buddhist and pagan beliefs, but his favorite wife was a Christian, same for his mother and one of his key generals. And he also followed the tradition of having Nestorians in his court, so all of these things clearly worked to influence him and enhance his communication prowess with the Christian kingdoms. Now the question is, did King Louis actually ever even get this letter? I saw varying sources. Some said that he never got it, others say that he got it and then sent it on to the Pope, who didn't want to ally with the Mongols. And honestly, if this is true, it's probably wise, because it's very likely the Mongols would have used them to defeat the Mamluks and then turn on them as they had previously done in Russia. Their enemy, the Cumans, had formed an alliance with other people of the area up in Eastern Europe, so going back to that overthrow of the Rus and Hungarian region. But when they did this alliance, they matched the Mongols in strength, and they were an impenetrable force. So the Mongols then convinced the Cumans to turn against their allies, and so they did. And once they had defeated their allies, they got turned on and got destroyed. So either way, the Crusaders and the Mongols never had a meaningful alliance. And in those later years, it wasn't because of bad blood, but actually due to inadequate communication. They could just never get their coordination right. The closest we got to it was the Ninth Crusade, which was a little bit of an alliance, and then the Second Council of Lyon in 1274, which saw a delegation of 13 Mongols attend, three of whom accepted baptism. Now, the Second Council of Lyon was primarily convened to reunite the Eastern and Western churches, which it did, temporarily. Pope Gregory X declared another crusade at this council, this time in an alliance with the Mongols. However, Europe was just kind of done. They wanted to move on. They had their own things to deal with, and the last several crusades had just been massive money and time sucks, which resulted in massive failure. And nobody wanted to commit, and so very little money was actually ever raised for it. The final nail in the literal coffin was that Pope Gregory X died a couple years later, and it fizzled out. So in total, there were 8 crusades, with the Ninth Crusade in 1272 really just being an extension of the Eighth Crusade. And the Crusader states would officially fall to the Mamluks a couple of decades later, ending 2 very interesting centuries in the Holy Land. Now, here I want to pivot to talk specifically about the impact and influence of Christianity on these 4 Mongol states. And as far as I can find, there is no substantial evidence of missions directed at the Ilkhanate. I'm sure they had some contact with missionaries, but nothing that seemed to lead to the establishment of a permanent mission or prominent conversions. They eventually withered away in 335 after the death of their last Khan. This was due in part to attacks from the Golden Horde, the Black Plague, and their strange acclimation to Islam. And by that, I mean that their soldiers and peasant class had adopted their religion faster than the nobility. And so this resulted in one of their kings towards the end having to literally buy supporters, which led to massive financial woes. And despite later converting to Islam fully, the Ilkhanate refused to align with the Mamluks, and so they just kind of faded away. In the Golden Horde, missions had existed at least since 1221, but not to the Mongols, but rather to their enemies, the Cumans. And it was established by the Dominicans and was at some point taken over by the Franciscans. And it seems as this mission had kind of fallen apart after the invasion of the Mongols in 1241. We know that the mission must have been somewhat successful, though, because William of Rubric ran into a couple of their converts while he was in Mongol territory. And then in the later part of the 1200s, the friars wrote to the Pope asking him to reestablish the diocese there. And the letter stated that they had had many friars among the Mongols, but there was no bishop to ordain them to priesthood. And the Pope promised to look into it, but nothing ever came of it. And so the diocese was never reestablished. One of the clearest and first evidences we have for missionary activity among the Golden Horde is actually a kerfuffle between the Christians and the Muslims in the Crimean town of Solkot, which occurred in 1287. And the Muslims there had shorn off the bell of the church because they were annoyed by its tolling. The friars then wrote to the local Mongol lords, who were also Muslim, asking them to intercede. And they sided with the Christians, allowing them to actually hang 3 bells instead of 1, which must have put a real burr in the saddle of the local Muslims there. And then one of the lord's wives came to visit the town and expressed her desire to be baptized, much to the joy of the friars there. They considered her their most significant convert, which is actually a little bit of a weird statement considering all your converts should be equal. But then her husband was something of a con maker because the next couple of cons for the Golden Horde came to power through his support. And some of them, or perhaps their sons, may also have been Christians, but it's kind of hard to say because the records are a bit muddled and there's name changes, and it's just there's nothing really that adds up to be 100% foolproof in accuracy. We do know that between 1310 to 1330, according to the internal documentation of the Franciscans, there were about 17 or 18 monasteries in the Golden Horde territories. And then there was this gradual shift when Uzbek or Ozbek Khan, who was also a Muslim, came to power. He's the guy that Uzbekistan is named for, as I mentioned before. He became Khan in 1313 and was, for the first half of his rule, very tolerant towards Christians. He gave the Franciscans tax-exempt status and allowed the Genoese merchants and traders to settle in Crimea. He also signed a new treaty with them that allowed them to rebuild the walls of the trading port city of Kaffa, which was really providential because these walls would hold off his son a few years later. But on the other hand, he forbade the ringing of the bells just 1 year after granting them permission to ring throughout the Khanate. And then a few years later, the forces of the governor of Crimea invaded the Genoese town that was 30 minutes south of Solkhot and vandalized the churches, taking down the bells and kicking out the Christians. So the Pope at the time then writes to Uzbek asking him to allow the repair of the churches and also to allow the Christians to move back in. This request went unheeded, and the town was repopulated with Turks, and the churches were turned into mosques. And then a few years later, after the death of Uzbek, his son, Yani Beg, decided to take Kaffa. Now, Kaffa was the premier trading commerce hub in the Black Sea region and was controlled by the Genoese. It specialized in the human slave trade and, as a result, made a lot of money. Money that Yani really wanted for himself. He actually tries to take it twice through the 1340s. The first time he sieges the city, they are run off once the Italian military comes. He returns a short while later, and then the two sides are at a stalemate. This is until the Black Death begins decimating the Mongol siege forces. Yani then decides to take his dead people and just hurl them over the walls into Kaffa, performing the first known case of biological warfare. The citizens naturally flee the city to escape this horrendous awfulness, and they try to go to mainland Europe. But unbeknownst to them, they are already infected and helped spread it across the continent. Yani then gives up Crimea and moves back up towards Russia. The Golden Horde eventually crumbles away bit by bit, although they do come back to Crimea and establish a Khanate there, which lasts until the expansion of the Russian Empire, which came and destroyed them in the late 1700s in an ironic full circle of justice. And now we finally arrive back at the Yuan Dynasty in China, the old stomping grounds of Genghis Khan, but we're talking about his grandson, Kublai Khan. The Yuan Dynasty is the only segment of the Mongols not to have been converted to Islam, but rather to Buddhism. And I think many of us are familiar with Kublai's request for 100 missionaries to come to his court, and this is often seen as a failure because only two were sent, and they turned back before they ever reached his court. And it actually appears to be a bit more complicated than that, though, because in 1269, after meeting Kublai Khan, Marco Polo's father and uncle arrived back in Venice with this request of Kublai's. He really wanted to learn more about Western learning and thought and the arts and sciences, and he thought that Christians, as the majority religion of Europe, would be good and well-rounded teachers for this. The only problem was that the Pope had died in 1268, and they were stalled in electing a new one. So a couple of years go by, and this time the Polos head back out with 17-year-old Marco Polo. And then they hear, as they're traveling back, that the new Pope has been elected. So then they backtrack to meet him and give him the letter. The Pope is still in the Holy Land and is not formally installed in Rome at this point, and this may be part of the reason why he is only able to send two friars with the Polos. He doesn't seem to have sent any more later on, although, to be fair, he was focused on uniting the Eastern and Western churches via the Second Council of Lyons, and then he dies just a couple years into his papacy. Marco Polo himself meets Kublai Khan when he's about 21 years old, and the Khan liked how intelligent and capable that he was and appointed him as a foreign emissary. And so Marco travels throughout China, into India and Burma on assignments for the Khan, and he was in service to Kublai for about 17 years before finally receiving permission to return home only after delivering a princess to the Ilkhanate Khan in Persia for marriage. And there doesn't seem to be a second request for Christians sent back with Marco, but in 1286, the Khan of the Ilkhanate sent a request for missionaries to be sent to Kublai Khan. John of Monte Corvino was entrusted with this task. He arrives in China in 1294 after taking several literal side quests, only to find that the Khan has just died. And he's still received by the new Khan and is allowed to carry on. So he builds two churches with space for 200 people, complete with workshops and living quarters. And apparently he gradually bought about 150 boys from their parents. Poor living conditions, perhaps, it's not clear. But these boys were anywhere from the ages of 7 to 11. He teaches them Latin and Greek. And then he wrote and translated psalms and hymns for them. And then trained them to serve mass and sing in the choir. And at the same time, he familiarized himself with the native language, preached in it, and translated into the Uyghur language the New Testament and the Psalms. And if you recall, this was the language used by the Mongol elite in China. And he is also credited with 6,000 converts, but it seems that many of these were probably rebaptized Nestorian Christians. For example, he's said to have converted King George of the Angud people, who were absorbed into the Mongol Empire. George was associated with the Church of the East, but then he converted to Catholicism simply, really, it just seems so that he could officiate a mass in his royal robes. But he allows John to build a Catholic church in the Angud capital, and then George still participates in the Eastern Church as well, so he just kind of takes little bits and pieces he likes. He is also said to be the descendant of this mysterious Prester John. How you could ever know that, I don't know. But like I said, Prester John just pops up everywhere. After our missionary John had worked for about 11 years all by himself, a colleague was sent to him. And then in 1307, the Pope, who was pleased with John's success, sent 7 Franciscans who were commissioned to consecrate him as the Archbishop of Beijing and the chief archbishop in the region. He dies about 20 years later, and it's unclear what happened to the other bishops because the last Khan of the Yuan dynasty wrote to the Pope and asked him to send more missionaries because they had been 8 years without a spiritual guide and really wanted one. So the Pope sends 50 more people and the missions in China continue for another 40 years until the Chinese rose up and kicked the Mongols out of China, establishing the Ming dynasty in 1368. The following year, the Ming had kicked out all of the Christians and shut down the missions because Christians were seen as influential allies of the Mongols, which honestly was true. And so here we get to the end of the reign of the Mongols and their history with Christianity. Is it a clear-cut story? No. Does it seem to be overly successful? Honestly, no. And while I'm sure there were some believers among the Mongols throughout history, it appears that the missionaries were more interested in their quick rebaptism into the Catholic Church than actual true heart conversion. And many of these converts maintained multiple religious beliefs and practiced them all interchangeably. Other factions of the empire converted to Islam in varying measures, likely maintaining a very similar system of syncretism. And I came across this interesting quote while I was doing this research. I found it on an Islamic apologetics website that was discussing the Mongol transition to Islam, specifically regarding conversions for economic gain. The quote itself actually comes from historian Peter Jackson. Once again, we have a Lord of the Rings reference, but it's not that Peter Jackson either. But I think this quote highlights the key difference between Christianity and other religions. It reads, "It is fruitless to write off a conversion of this kind as partial or insincere, since we occupy no vantage point that enables us to judge the wholeheartedness of Mongol rulers who accepted Islam. All too often, such judgments are predicated on views of conversion, revolving around a profound inward change that owe more to Western Christian expectations and experience." Now, this clarification of Western Christian expectations is unnecessary because true Christian conversions on every continent have resulted in an inward profound change that has displayed outward and has changed entire societies. And I've mentioned this before on previous episodes, but it really can't be stressed enough that the outworking of true Christian conversion has led to the abolition of slavery, the ending of infanticides, human sacrifices, the establishment of schools, hospitals, and orphanages. And these are the fruits of the profound inward changes that take place when people truly accept Jesus as Lord and Savior. I hope you enjoyed this episode, even though it wasn't necessarily a happy ending. I think it's still important to examine these times in history that were kind of failures. And it also personally makes me really grateful for the Protestant Reformation and the later Age of Missions, which did and do see true conversions in many parts of the former Mongol Empire. As always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. Instead, go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI and a watch and tab on any plan. Only on Verizon.
With new line on my plan, service plan required for watch and tab. Additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Sometimes things get in the way. Big obstacles, little setbacks. But you keep going through the grind, the long nights. With flexible pathways, online, hybrid, and in-person, Indiana Wesleyan University gives you accessible tuition with world-class connections. Where there's a will, there's a way. And with Indiana Wesleyan, there's a way forward. Start today at discovertheway.com.